Good day. Today is Monday, 18th May 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me remind you again to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. Well, in my programme yesterday, I discussed at some length Ukraine's drone attack on Russia, its massive drone attack on Russia, which came soon after a equally massive, but I would argue far more powerful, Russian drone and missile attack on Ukraine. Well, yesterday, last night, it was again the Russians' turn. They struck back at Ukraine, and they struck back with drones and missiles, and quite a significant number of missiles were used, including Iskander-Ms and KH-101 subsonic cruise missiles and Calibra missiles and weapons of that kind. But the fact that this attack took place is not what is attracting the greatest attention as of this morning. What is attracting greatest attention is a video which has appeared, which purports to show a strike by the Russians on some facility in the city of Dnipro. And it is another one of those pictures, video pictures, with which I've become very familiar with, seeing the video footage of the Oreshnik strike on the Yuzhmash factory in Dnipro in November 2024, and the video footage of the Oreshnik strike on the airbase near Lvov in January 2026. If this video footage is real, then it appears to show something very similar, again, a kind of extraordinary light effect in the night sky, connected to some sort of extraordinary strike on some kind of facility in Dnipro. And of course, there's lots of speculation that another Oreshnik strike has taken place. Now, I want to stress at this point that all of this is indeed, so far, merely speculation. The Ukrainians and the West are not referring to an Oreshnik strike on Dnipro, but then in general, they tend to avoid discussing strikes by these extraordinarily powerful Russian hypersonic missiles, precisely because the West has no analogue, and I don't think they want the Western public to engaged or worried about the fact that the Russians have these extremely powerful weapons and NATO for the moment doesn't. And as for the Ukrainians, obviously they prefer to downplay the significance of strikes with Oreshniks and similar hypersonic systems. Having said that, it's also the case that the Russians themselves officially have said nothing about this strike that would lead one to think that an attack with an Oreshnik on the city of Dnipro has actually taken place. This is the Russian Defense Ministry's account of the strike that took place last night. Last night, in response to Ukraine's terrorist attacks on civilian facilities on the territory of Russia, the armed forces of the Russian Federation carried out a massive strike by ground-based, naval-based, high-precision weapons and attack drones against enterprises of the Ukrainian defense industry, fuel power facilities, as well as transport and port infrastructure facilities used by the armed forces of Ukraine and military airfields. The goal of the strike has been achieved. All the assigned targets have been engaged. There is no reference here to anoreshnik or to hypersonic weapons or to anything of that sort at all. And, well, if there was a strike on Dnipro involving an anoreshnik missile or a missile similar to an anoreshnik, I have to say I find that this complete absence of any confirmation of the fact from the Russian Defense Ministry, I have to say I find it rather strange. And, well, one must guard for the possibility that the video footage, which seems to show something very like an anoreshnik strike, is a fabrication of some kind, that someone has produced this video footage and circulated it in order to give the impression that there was an anoreshnik strike last night, when in fact there was no such thing. And I noticed that several commentators are already making points about how certain aspects of the flashes in this video seem to differ from what one normally expects to see following anoreshnik strikes. There are discrepancies between these flashes and the ones that we saw during the strike on the Yuzhmash factory in Dnipro and the airbase in Lvov. And there's some speculation that this is because the Russians might have used an entirely new and different missile system altogether, one that is different from the anoreshnik in some particular. But it seems to me that another possible explanation for the discrepancy is that this isn't an actual video footage of a real strike at all, but something that somebody has fabricated. So I have to say this because I know that there are reports and speculations about this all over the media, especially social media, this morning. But for the moment at least, I think there is a real question mark over this strike. Now, having said that, there are also reports that directly following this strike, there were massive railway delays across Ukraine, such as might suggest that something was attacked in Dnipro that triggered them. And, well, that might be confirmation that a big strike on some important facility in Dnipro, the city of Dnipro, did indeed take place. And this has had some wider effect on the Ukrainian transport system. One commentator, Dima at the Military Summary Channel, has suggested that the strike might have targeted some kind of decision-making centre, a command facility, perhaps operated by Ukraine's general staff, based in Dnipro. Certainly that is possible. Dnipro definitely is used by the Ukrainians as a key logistics hub and command point. But again, I would want some more evidence of this before I assumed it to be true. Certainly, the disruption in the railway system is suggestive of something, but it's worth pointing out that the Russians did also conduct a massive strike across Ukraine, hitting targets in all sorts of other places. and it may be that the destruction was caused by that rather than by this strike if it took place against some unknown facility in the city of Dnipro. Well, I apologise for talking about this at such length, but as I said, there's been a lot of discussion about it on the internet. I want to stress that one way or the other, I don't know what the truth is, but I am a little doubtful. Perhaps over the next 24 hours, these doubts will be resolved. Anyway, let's talk about the overall situation in Ukraine as of this morning on the battlefronts. I say this because, again, the media across the West continues to insist that the direction of the war has changed, that it is the Ukrainians, not the Russians, who held the initiative, that the Russians over the last few months have lost more men than they recruited, and that it is the Ukrainians themselves who are gaining territory. Now, in my opinion, none of that is true. I discussed yesterday, in my video, the Ukrainian drone attack. I have pointed out that for once, the Russians provided us with very detailed information about what was actually hit by the Ukrainians in the city of Moscow itself, and it is clear that Moscow was indeed the main target. And of course, in discussing what the Russians are saying, one always has to be careful. They no doubt do have a vested interest in downplaying the significance of this Ukrainian strike. But for the record, I tend to believe what the Russians say about these things, and the information they gave was that the Ukrainian strike, vast as it was, involving large numbers of drones, as it did, was unable to penetrate the Russian air defense system, protecting Moscow to any very great or concerning degree, that much of the damage done was done against apartment buildings and things of that kind, which I assume were not the intended Ukrainian targets, and that none of the major industrial plants or facilities in Moscow and none of the primary military targets were damaged, let alone destroyed. There has been confirmation from the Russians that, contrary to what I said in my program yesterday, the Ukrainians did attempt to launch missiles in conjunction with this drone attack. The Russians say that they shot down one Flamingo cruise missile and one Neptune anti-ship missile, which is somewhat like an American Harpoon missile, and which the Ukrainians have adapted for land use. Again, there's no word of any further missiles over and above these two, which the Russians say they shot down, having been used. And for the record, if any more Ukrainian missiles were used, it looks as if the Russians either intercepted and destroyed them, even though they're not saying as much, or they missed their targets, because there's no record of Ukrainian missiles doing any major damage over the course of the Ukrainian attack yesterday. But of course, the Russian attack, the one that took place last night, that appears to be different. It looks as if there was major strikes again on energy facilities and as the Russian Defense Ministry says, on airfields. The giant airfield at Starokonstantinov was again a primary target for attack. And, well, there's reason to think that some aircraft were destroyed over the course of this attack. But perhaps more interesting is what continues to happen on the battlefronts. And, well, there continue to be reports of a major Russian breakthrough now in Konstantinovka, the southernmost town of the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk-Konstantinovka conurbation. There appears to be now conclusive proof that at least part of the Ukrainian garrison in Konstantinovka is in a cauldron. And there were reports this morning, which have appeared on Ukrainian channels, that the Ukrainian military are worried about a crisis developing in Konstantinovka and generally in Donbass, and that they are redeploying all their forces to try to hold the positions there to the extent that they can. Anyway, what we see from all of this information is that in terms of the war in the sky and in terms of the war on the ground, there is actually no real evidence, no evidence at all, that corroborates the claim that the Ukrainians are gaining the initiative in Zaporozhye, in Kharkov and Sumy region, in the area of Liman and Sviatogorsk and Barova and Kupiansk, by the way, in the northern Donbass, close to the town of Slavyansk. It is the Russians who are gaining ground. The Russians are also gaining ground near Kramatorsk, with allegedly 40% of the important settlement of Rai Alexandrovka now under Russian control. The Russians appear to be achieving a significant advance in Konstantinovka, pointing to eventual collapse of the Ukrainian resistance in that city. And this morning, the Russian Defense Ministry finally, formally confirmed the capture of Grishino, north of Pokrovsk. This particular village is widely accepted, has been under Russian control for some time. The fact that the Russian Defense Ministry now officially confirms the fact suggests that the Russians are confident that they have consolidated fully their control, not just of Grishino, but of the area surrounding it. So it looks as if it's the Russians who hold the initiative, both in the sky and on ground. And as for claims that over the last few months, the Ukrainians have exacted a bigger toll of Russian casualties than the Russians have recruited soldiers. Well, I don't believe that. But besides, some weeks ago, I discussed a piece by the blogger who calls himself Events in Ukraine, and he pointed out that data that Ukraine itself publishes strongly argues against this claim. On the contrary, according to Ukraine's own data, the Russians have lost fewer men this autumn sorry, this winter and spring than they did during the winter, the late winter and spring of last year. So the trend for Russian casualties, and this is according to Ukrainian data, is for those casualties, the number of those casualties, to fall rather than to increase. So why are the Europeans persisting in pretending otherwise? Why do they tell each other and tell the media that the situation on the front lines, in the sky, in the Russian economy, we'll come to that in a moment, why do they persist in claiming that the balance, the advantage, has shifted to Ukraine, when the actual data, the information we have, tells the diametrically opposite story? Well, I am going to come up with my own suggestion. And it is based, it derives from something that was said, I believe, yesterday by the foreign minister of Estonia. He said that it's not appropriate to talk to the Russians now, because even though many in Europe are now demanding it, the reality is that Ukraine has the Russians on the back foot. It's not the Russians who hold the initiative. It is the Ukrainians who hold the initiative. And given that the Ukrainians hold the initiative, we shouldn't make life easier for the Russians by negotiating with them. We should sit back and let the Ukrainians press on, so that we end up, we in the West, end up in an even better position of ultimate advantage than we otherwise would. Well, I'm going to say two things about this. Firstly, we have been here before. Back in 2022, after Ukraine's Kharkiv and Kherson counteroffensives, General Milley, who was at that time the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of the United States, suggested that now might be a good moment for Ukraine to cash its winnings, its successes, its supposed victory in the Battle of Kiev in the spring of 2022, its indisputably successful counteroffensive in Kharkiv region in the summer and early autumn of 2022, its only very partially successful counteroffensive in Kherson region. General Milley advised that that was what Ukraine should do. But then I remember all sorts of people saying exactly the same thing then that the Estonian foreign minister is saying now. Well, precisely because Ukraine holds the initiative, precisely because it is gaining the advantage on the battle lines, precisely because it is winning, now is not the time to speak to the Russians. All that does is get them off the hook. When we need to keep them on the hook, we need to instead back the Ukrainians, give them all we've got, and that way they will get a victory and will put themselves in a far stronger negotiating position than the one they would be in if we press them to negotiate now. So that was the autumn of 2022. And in fact, that view was universally accepted. And in the autumn of 2022, all sorts of Western governments, starting with France, but then including Britain, Germany, the United States, then decided that they would support the supposed Ukrainian success by supplying Ukraine with tanks and armored vehicles and all sorts of other weapons which had been withheld up to that moment, so as to put Ukraine in an even stronger position, one that it would achieve by pressing forward with its successful, what was anticipated to be its successful offensive of the summer of 2023, which aimed to break through to the Sea of Azov and to the Black Sea and to cut off Crimea from Russia. So that was what people said then, and it turned out disastrously. The offensive, the Ukrainian offensive, was comprehensively defeated, and the Ukrainians had been basically on the back foot ever since. Well, now, according to this narrative, when the Ukrainians are on the initiative, though, as I said, there's no actual evidence that they are, we see the same line being trotted out all over again. I would add that, in fact, whatever happens in the war, those who in the West oppose negotiations and any discussions with the Russians always find some reason not to engage in the discussions. If the Ukrainians are purportedly doing well, as they briefly were in 2022, and as according to the prevailing narrative they are doing now, we don't talk, because if we do, we will fail to gain the fruit of that wonderful victory that is just there beyond the horizon. Whereas if the war begins to go very badly wrong, if it is the Ukrainians who are being pushed back and defeated, then the argument you get is that this isn't the time to speak to the Russians, because the Russians are going to be cocky and they're going to increase their demands because they're confident of victory. You must never talk to the Russians from a position of weakness, supposedly. So what you've got to do is you've got to support Ukraine even more in order to redress the balance, in order to prevent a negotiation which would lead to the Russians achieving perhaps all of their main goals. So if the Ukrainians are doing well, you support them and oppose talks. And if the Ukrainians are doing badly, you support them and oppose talks. Anyway, I've explored all of this and I've discussed the illogic, complete illogic of this position. But I'm going to suggest that there is something deeper here, and I've touched on it already, which is that I think that ultimately what the Estonian foreign minister says is the key to the entire narrative. That the reason we are now hearing these untrue stories about the Ukrainians gaining the initiative, inflicting more injury and death on the Russians than the Russians are recruiting soldiers. The reason for all of these performative drone strikes on Russia and on Moscow specifically is precisely in order to provide the excuse for not negotiating with the Russians. You spread these stories about Ukrainian success. You know that in summit meetings in Europe of European leaders, nobody is going to screw up the courage to contradict you. If any leader were to do so, you would immediately accuse them of simply recycling Putin talking points. So you pretend that things are continuing to go well because, following from what the Estonian foreign minister has said, you want that to become your reason for not talking to the Russians. And I think this explains the whole narrative, and it also explains the drone attack. You have to conduct these enormous performative drone attacks. It doesn't matter how much damage you actually do, provided you can provide images that in the minds of the Western public sustain this myth that you are on the front foot working towards some sort of mystery, some sort of victory, sorry. So that, I think, is what this whole thing is ultimately about. When you scratch deeper, the doubts that are really there very quickly come to the surface. There's lots of reports now. You can find them all over the media in the West. I was reading an article about this in the Daily Telegraph this morning about how weapon supplies, or at least supplies of precision-guided weapons to the Europeans from the United States, have come to a complete standstill. The US has critically depleted its inventories. It's now talking about renewing the war with Iran. It has to husband every missile of every category that it has in order to wage that conflict with Iran. It is very conscious that China is breathing down its back. So there is nothing to spare for the Europeans, let alone the Ukrainians. Apparently, the Trump administration's decision to cancel or postpone delivery of Tomahawk missiles to Germany, a deeply misconceived idea, by the way, one which was proposed and accepted when Joe Biden was president, just saying. The American decision to cancel that particular delivery, which has caused great angst amongst the hardline faction in Germany, in Berlin, well, it is mostly motivated by the critical depletion of American arsenals and the fact that at the present time, the United States simply does not have Tomahawk missiles to spare. And it isn't just weapons that are in short supply. Manpower is also. The Ukrainians don't have enough manpower to hold their entire front line. They must juggle around units from one part of the front line to the other. They're having to do that at the moment because of the critical situation in Konstantinovka and Donbass, where Ukrainian troops are now apparently under instructions to go. And, well, what that in turn has led to is apparently a further series of demands from European leaders made to Zelensky at the recent summit meeting in Yerevan, where the European leaders told Zelensky that if he did indeed want more weapons, Ukraine needed to address its critical manpower problem by lowering the mobilization age for the soldiers it conscripts. Now, this has been a terrible, incredible, cynical game that the West has played with Ukraine. The Ukrainians themselves, very resistant to being conscripted altogether, particularly strongly opposed to conscription of the critically small 18-year-old male demographic in Ukraine. Ukraine being currently in the midst of a major demographic crisis. But apparently, despite all of that, caring apparently little about the fact that there is this demographic crisis, the Europeans nonetheless come back and insist that Ukraine must conscript younger men, lowering the age of conscription, some reports are saying, all the way down to 18. So the fact that this these demands are being made again strongly suggests to me that despite all of the official claims in Europe, or semi-official claims in Europe, about Ukrainian success on the battlefields and about this not being the right time to talk, the Europeans are actually extremely nervous. They want the Ukrainians to recruit more men. And apparently, there were even some European officials who told Zelensky in Cyprus that unless he did lower the conscription age, something which, to his credit, he has been consistently unwilling to do, but that unless that happened, the flow of Western weapons, of European weapons, to Ukraine might now start to run down. So that's apparently what Zelensky was told. So far, he's shown no willingness to do this, but the pressures on him are growing. We've had the revival of the corruption scandal, which I've discussed in many programs, and I pointed out that this could not happen without a clear green light to restart the corruption scandal having come from the West. So it could be that the corruption scandal, apart from the other many things that it might be, might also be intended to put pressure on Zelensky to do unpopular things like lower the conscription age. Just saying. But anyway, the problems Zelensky's having with the corruption scandal, as I said, might be part of all of this. And it might also be part of all of this that, according to Russian reports, which again need to be handled with especially great care here, the dragnet of the anti-corruption investigation is now literally starting to lap at Zelensky's feet, because supposedly, and again this is all from Russian sources, I'm not in any way vouching for the truth of this, But supposedly, the Ukrainian authorities, NABU and SAPO, are on the brink of arresting and bringing charges against Zelensky's own wife, who presumably they would be trying to turn to give evidence against him. Just as I now, on balance, think that the narrative of Ukrainian success has been created in order to see off this pressure in Europe, which basically began in December, to open negotiations with the Russians. So I wonder whether the corruption scandal that's now been launched ultimately against Zelensky in Kiev isn't about forcing him to lower the conscription age, something which, as I said, he has shown immense unwillingness up to now to do. Well, all of this, obviously, but of course, one of the paradoxes is that the Europeans, looking for excuses not to negotiate with the Russians, at the moment are in no position themselves to negotiate with the Russians. There's been an article about this in Politico. It says that the Europeans cannot agree on a chief negotiator. All sorts of unlikely characters have been proposed, all of whom I think would inspire deep distrust in Moscow. Some are apparently suggesting the former chancellor, the former German chancellor, Angela Merkel. This completely overlooks the fact that in Moscow and on the part of Vladimir Putin personally, Merkel is now completely persona non grata. She is remembered as the person who tricked Putin with the Minsk agreement in 2015 into agreeing to a ceasefire in the conflict in Donbass on the strength of a promise to implement an agreement, the Minsk agreement, which Ukraine, Merkel, the Europeans and the West in general never had the slightest intention of honouring. I wouldn't go so far as to say that for the Russians, Merkel is the worst of all possible choices, but that wouldn't be so far from the truth. Anyway, she's one person who's been suggested. Another person who's been suggested is Mario Draghi, the former Italian technocrat prime minister and the former head of the EU's central bank. I think he's only marginally more acceptable to the Russians than Merkel would be. Draghi is the European leader who, before the start of the special military operation, was apparently telling the Russians that he didn't really believe in sanctions, and if sanctions were imposed, it would be all the fault of those hardline North Europeans, and Italy itself should be given some sort of leeway by the Russians. The Russians should continue to sell Italy at bargain prices, their oil and gas, irrespective of what formal sanctions the Europeans on Russia impose. Now, I don't think the Russians have forgotten any of this, and I think they've long since come to the conclusion that, a bit like Emmanuel Macron, and indeed Angela Merkel, Matt Draghi is an obsessive Russophobe who simply cannot be trusted, certainly not trusted in negotiations. And, well, Politico says that very reluctantly various European officials have come to understand that the EU's own foreign minister, Kaya Kallas, cannot be Europe's lead negotiator with the Russians because, well, she is so virulently hostile to the Russians that the Russians suspect and strongly oppose her altogether. And that, of course, is entirely true. If you wanted to pick a lead negotiator that was even worse than Merkel and Draghi, from a Russian point of view, that would certainly be Kaya Kallas. Frankly, if the Europeans are foolish enough to appoint Kaya Kallas their chief negotiator, I think the Russians will take that as proof that the Europeans are not really interested in negotiations, and they will point this out to their allies in China and India and Brazil, and they will say, why are you constantly telling us to negotiate with the Europeans and with the Ukrainians? That when you can see that the person who the Europeans are appointing to negotiate with us is none other than that most compulsive opponent of Russia of all, which is to say Kaya Kallas. So I think that is, again, a fantastic, grotesque mistake. I do want to see the Europeans restart a dialogue with the Russians. I do think it's time for the Europeans to appoint a chief negotiator. But none of the names I've seen remotely qualify for that role, be it Merkel or Draghi or Kallas, or indeed Alexander Stubb, the president of Finland, who is very much persona non grata in the Kremlin. But Politico says that the Europeans can't get past first base because they are unable to agree amongst themselves a lead negotiator. And, well, that is obviously true. So, in the absence of a chief negotiator, no negotiations can take place anyway. Now, what I think the Europeans don't realise is that the Russians don't particularly want to negotiate with them. One of the most interesting developments of the last few hours is a very interesting interview that has been provided to the TASS news agency by Galuzin, one of the top Russian negotiators who participated in the negotiations in Abu Dhabi and Geneva a few months ago, and who is, of course, a deputy foreign minister of Russia. And he gave, Galuzin gave this information, not actually to TASS, but to Izvestia, a major Russian newspaper, a major heavyweight, going all the way back to the Soviet times. But anyway, this is what Galuzin said. We have received no signals from Kiev regarding its willingness to make a meaningful progress in resolving the conflict. for successful negotiations, Zelensky will need to order the Ukrainian armed forces to cease fire and pull troops from Donbass and Russian regions. Then it will be possible to negotiate specific parameters of a truly comprehensive, just and lasting peace. It will be a challenging negotiation process, but we are ready for it. Now, these are actually very interesting words of Galuzin's, because notice the formula he's using. Zelensky will need to order the Ukrainian armed forces to cease fire and pull troops from Donbass and Russian regions. That differentiates Donbass, which according to the Russian constitution is now a part of Russia, from these, inverted commas, Russian regions. Well, what are these Russian regions? Well, Zaporozhye and Kherson immediately spring to mind. There's been a huge amount of speculation that in Anchorage in August, Putin agreed with Trump that there could be a ceasefire, provided the Ukrainians withdrew from Donbass. Even if the Ukrainians did not withdraw from Zaporozhye and Kherson, as Putin himself said they should in his speech to the foreign ministry on the 14th of June 2024, when he set out Istanbul Plus. Well, even if they don't withdraw from these two regions, if they at least withdraw from Donbass, we can actually get a ceasefire. And in that case, we can move forward with negotiations. But Galuzin is not saying that at all. He's saying something quite different. He says that Zelensky will need to order the Ukrainian armed forces to cease fire and pull troops from Donbass and Russian regions. And the Russian regions obviously are Zaporozhye and Kherson. So this famous concession that Putin is supposed to have made in Anchorage, that if the Ukrainians pull out of Donbass, the Russians will accept a freeze on the rest of the front line, including in Zaporozhye and Kherson. Well, if you read these words literally by Galuzin, then that is not true. I doubt that Galuzin, who is a deputy foreign minister, and as I said, somebody who is part of Russia's negotiating team in the negotiations with Ukraine, which have taken place in Istanbul, Abu Dhabi and Geneva over the course of this conflict, I think it is absolutely inconceivable that Galuzin doesn't know the actual Russian negotiating position. But the point is that whether this interpretation of his words is right or wrong, the fact remains that the demand Galuzin is making, a Ukrainian withdrawal, at least from Donbass, but in Galuzin's formula, involving all of the territory in Ukraine, which Russia now says is its own, well, that is a completely unacceptable demand for Zelensky. It is not something that he will ever agree to. So there is unreality about all of this at multiple levels. the Europeans are busy arguing with each other about a chief negotiator to negotiate with the Russians. But they're not only unable to agree on a candidate, but they are not prepared to make the vital concession of a Ukrainian withdrawal, which is needed to get these talks that the Europeans say they want, and the ceasefire, which they also say they want. This is not enough to get any of that started. In the meantime, all sorts of other rumours continue to circulate. Yesterday, the Russian internet was full of stories, apparently originating from Russian officials, that the corruption investigations in Kiev are about to escalate. Supposedly, Zelensky's own wife is now likely to be arrested very soon. Again, given that this information comes from Russian sources, I would treat this information with great care. But for the record, my own very clear view is that if the war is going to end, it's going to end on the battlefields, not through negotiations. And I myself am sceptical that the anti-corruption negotiations in the end are going to lead to any fundamental change in the political situation in Kiev itself or in President Zelensky's position or in the stance that the Europeans are taking. Well, that's what I'm going to say about the situation in Ukraine. Now, even as the situation in Ukraine deteriorates, there are now more and more reports, mounting reports, that the United States is now reviewing its options and is considering a renewal of the conflict with Iran. The United States, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, as I have already explained, went to China. He did not achieve any very positive outcome from his point of view there. In fact, the only substantive thing that happened over the course of that visit is that he got a very strong warning about Taiwan from President Xi. So, as is always the case with this president, when he meets a rebuff of that kind, he comes back to Washington determined to redress the balance, to show that he and the United States are still strong, and one assumes, one expects that he's going to be thinking again about military action against Iran in order to show to the Chinese and to others that the United States remains strong after all. Now, I have to say that if an attack of that kind against Iran takes place at any point over the next few days, then I have no doubt at all that Iran is going to retaliate. For the moment, there are nowhere near enough US troops in the area around Iran, so far as I can see, to make possible any sustained incursion on the Iranian mainland. I am guessing that we will again be back to attacks on civilian infrastructure, or perhaps attempts or discussions of attempts to seize specific Iranian islands. None of that is going to have a decisive effect in the war. The Iranians have shown that they have the ability to mount massive and very powerful counterstrikes across the Middle East. The US media and US intelligence agencies admit that Iran's missile stockpiles remain mostly intact, in contrast to the situation with US stockpiles, which have now been critically depleted. Attacks and attempts to capture islands come with considerable risks and could leave US troops marooned on those islands. This is something that has been pointed out by people with military backgrounds like Daniel Davis, Joe Kent, Jim Webb, people like that. So it still seems to me that military options are not good. And if it is indeed the case that they're being reconsidered, well, a rebuff in China is not a good reason. I'm going to add here a further point as well. The President of the United States has currently ordered a US blockade of Iran. If he is indeed going to now turn to that kind of military action, the military action that is now being speculated about, well, what is that if not an admission that this naval blockade of Iran that he has mounted is not succeeding, that it is not suffocating Iran in the way that he hoped, and that it is not by itself enough to bring the Iranians to terms, or at least to get the Iranians to accept the terms that he, the president, wants them to accept. So, in that case, what was all that business with the blockade? Just say. Well, put all that aside. The reality, of course, is that what is pushing the president anyway towards escalation, if that is indeed where we end up, is clearly the deteriorating situation in energy markets. There's a wide consensus that June here is the critical month. If there's no sign that the Strait of Hormuz is going to reopen by June, then energy costs are going to spiral upwards and we're going to start to look at shortages of energy and fuel start to expand around the world, with the situation continuing to get steadily worse until we finally reach a crisis in the autumn. The underlying problem, I suspect, with the blockade is that it was never going to work quickly enough for the president and for the United States if it was ever going to work at all. Well, the reality is that, in my opinion, military strikes are simply going to take us back to where we were in March and April. The Americans launching strikes at the Iranians launching counter-strikes against the United States and the US's allies in the Middle East. The United States unable to deal a knockout blow on the Iranians, but the Iranians having the potential to deal devastating damage, for example, if it comes to it, by attacking desalination plants in Saudi Arabia. And it seems to me that the risk for the president, if he decides to go down that path, is that some of the Persian Gulf states, the Saudis first and foremost, might conclude that this is becoming for them a losing enterprise, that they're becoming too much hostages to an American and Israeli adventure that is going completely wrong and which the president doesn't seem to know how to extricate the United States from, and that that might be the moment when the Saudis finally decide that they have no option but to start to distance themselves from the United States by closing their airspace, demanding that the US evacuate its bases, and by perhaps by engaging maybe through the Chinese or the Russians in bilateral negotiations with the Iranians, which will finally remove from Saudi Arabia the ongoing threat of the war. Now, that actually might in some respects resolve the crisis. If Saudi Arabia, Kuwait and Qatar were to cut some kind of direct deal with the Iranians, that probably would result in the Strait of Hormuz being reopened, at least in some form. It would allow ships to transit. It would mean that the American blockade of Iran would collapse, because realistically, the United States is not going to start seizing ships carrying Saudi or Qatari or Kuwaiti oil destined for Europe. And in a kind of a way, it would end the crisis. But it would do so in circumstances that would be very humiliating for the United States, because the United States would not have achieved its objective in Iran, regime change there, or even its lesser objectives, an end to ballistic missile development and the end of Iran's support for its various regional allies, the Houthis in Yemen, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and all that. And it would not even have achieved anything in connection with uranium enrichment, which would presumably be capable of being continued by Iran in that kind of scenario on its own territory without the United States realistically being able to do much about it. So I suspect that if the Saudis and the Qataris and the Kuwaitis cut that kind of deal, it would resolve the crisis and end the war, but it would be a major political defeat for Donald Trump and for the United States. That, I think, is starting to become a more realistic scenario than I thought it might be a few weeks ago. Though I still think that there are obstacles, and I think that there would be many people in Saudi Arabia who would still be nervous on making that kind of break from the United States. But going beyond that, there may be something else that the United States needs to keep in mind. Now, Ted Postol, Professor Postol, has recently been saying that Iran now has a sufficiently large stockpile of enriched uranium to enrich it further. And the Iranians themselves have now recently been saying that they are considering enriching their stockpile up to 90% level. Now, I understand that that would put Iran well within sights of developing nuclear weapons. And Professor Postol appears to believe that Iran, in that case, would be able to develop up to a dozen nuclear weapons within a relatively short period. I am no expert on these things, and I'm certainly not going to second guess Professor Postol's views on these kind of matters. He is, of course, a rocket scientist, but he knows many people who are involved in the nuclear weapons industry. He has information and he can get advice on these sort of things that are certainly not accessible to someone like me. Well, if we end up in that situation, we are in an enormous crisis. Not only would Iran be obtaining nuclear weapons, but the president, what he has set out to do, would have visibly and catastrophically failed. One does wonder, actually, whether if it did seem that Iran were indeed moving in that direction, that the United States and Israel would stand idle, and whether they might not try to preempt any move by Iran to acquire nuclear weapons capability by conducting some kind of strike against Iran, potentially with nuclear weapons of their own. Now, these are nightmare scenarios, and I don't want to discuss or explore them too much in programs which might anticipate the event. All I would say is that everything tells me that a return to war is a mistake, that it's only going to deepen the crisis that we already see. There is a deal that can be done with the Iranians. It would take us back to something not that different from the JCPOA. That might be difficult for the president to sell to the Israelis and to some of the more hardline figures in the United States, people like John Bolton, for example. But it still seems to me far and away the better option than to take what is already a very bad situation and to make it still worse. Well, that is anyway my view. This is where I'm going to finish today's programme. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programmes on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X and Substack. Please remember that you can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.